those common terms are truly existent, things that are truly existent, and also inherently. So these all have slightly different, and sometimes considerably large differences in meaning. But they're used in the different schools. So just to go back to remind you from last week, there are four major schools of Buddhist philosophy. In philosophy, referring to investigating, interpreting the Buddhist teachings about the nature of reality. So the simplest basic school is called the Vaibhashika school. Then there is one called the Sautantrika school. And these two schools are schools belonging to the system of teachings that the Buddha taught that lead to individual liberation. Then there are the Mahayana schools, the Mahayana tradition. So that tradition, the teachings of the Buddha, the Mahayana, teach us not, encourage us not to achieve just a nirvana for ourselves, but to achieve enlightenment, so that we're in a position to benefit all sentient beings. So within that, there are two philosophical schools. Mahayana is a philosophical school. It's a system of teachings leading to enlightenment. This system, which is put out physically in here, it's almost primitive to use the Hinayana tradition. It's a system of teachings and practices that lead just to our own enlightenment. But within those, there are the philosophical schools of explaining, interpreting those teachings about what he meant when he said that everything is selfless. Yeah, so there's the Vaibhashika and Sautantrika, the Hinayana schools or schools of individual relation. The only school of this tradition now surviving in the world, because there were many, were about 16 originally. The only one left is the Theravada tradition. Which is the dominant form of Buddhism in Thailand, Sri Lanka, Burma, Southeast Asia. So then within the Mahayana tradition, there are two philosophical schools, the Chittamatra or Chittamatrin, which is the mind-only school. The mind-only school. And the Madhyamika school, Madhyamika meaning middle way. So some of you, probably all of you, have heard this term middle way. So this is used in two, it's used in a very general way. All Buddhist schools and traditions argue that they follow the middle way of here, and they use that term. I'm not talking about philosophical school, we're talking about the claim that the Buddha, his way of practice, was a middle way between the two extremes, the extreme asceticism and extreme indulgence. At least a lot of the other non-Buddhist schools tended to follow to either go to one the very extreme, extremely ascetic, or some went the other way and were very hedonistic. So Buddhism claims to be a middle way between those two. But here, we're talking about a philosophical school within Buddhism, which is the Majjhima, the middle way philosophical school. Right. So the point I'm trying to make here is that these different schools use these different terminologies, but the nudging, and one thing just to remind people that I mentioned last week is that according to Tibetan Buddhism, particularly the Buddha school that we follow, the actual view of the Buddha about the nature of reality is presented in the Majjhimika Prajnaparamita school. Or each of these four schools of Tibetan Buddhism, we have the four codes because this is the less description of what we think. It's always interesting, the more complicated and important the dying topic is, the more likely there's going to be obstacles and obstructions. So each of these four general philosophical schools has sub-schools, which I won't go into much. But the Majjhimika school has two sub-schools, the Prajnaparamita school and the Svatantrika. As I mentioned last week, the Prajnaparamita means consequence. The reason it's called that is because Nagarjuna is the source of this school. The way he refutes the views of the non-Buddhists and also these other Buddhist schools is he points out the illogical consequences of their views. If they would argue that things are like this because of this and this reason, and they believe that their logic proves their conclusion, and not that you can say actually a logical result of their argument is this. And this logical conclusion is rubbish. It's just absurd. So he would point out the absurd consequences of the arguments of the other schools. So it's called the consequence school. That's one thing. That's one system in the rules. It's not really uninteresting. So anyway, Lama Tsongkhapa proved that by analysing all the sutras of the Buddha, that in fact the actual meaning that the Buddha himself had to realise the nature of reality is contained in the teachings called the Majjhimika Prajnaparamita school. So all the other schools are slightly wrong, they haven't got it wrong. Even though they were taught by the Buddha, they're not completely correct. And as I mentioned last week, if one could lose faith in the Buddha by thinking, why did he teach things which were wrong? The reason he taught things which were not completely correct is because it's extremely difficult to understand this highest Buddha, the Majjhimika Prajnaparamita view. And it's difficult to understand, but it's very easy to misunderstand it. And people have been doing it for 2,500 years, misunderstanding it, and thinking that you're in this for everything, but it's really about emptiness, the nature of reality, what that means is nothing exists at all. So that becomes very scary. It doesn't actually mean that, but many people, it's very easy to make that mistake. So in the Tibetan system, especially in the Gurukula tradition, what is emphasized is that in order to understand the Majjhimika Prajnaparamita school of emptiness, the nature of reality, correctly, completely correctly, not make any mistakes, it's important to first understand the Vaibhishekha school, what their interpretation is, because theirs is the simplest one to understand, even though it's not. It's not, it is wrong, but it's not completely wrong. It's got some things right. Of course, they say they're completely right. Many of these are wrong. Big arguments. So anyway, the Majjhimika Prajnaparamita practitioners in the Buddhist school say to get that view correctly, firstly one needs to understand this view, then the Svatantrika view, then the Chittamatta view, then the Majjhimika like to enter the view, or eventually run the light expanding the present view of the view. And so part of that present view of the view is that all the other schools below him have different interpretations of all of these things. And what the present view of the school say that all these terms are in fact synonymous. They all come down to the same things, because the big difference between the Majjhimika Prajnaniga school and all the other schools is all the other schools believe in the inherent existence, the things inherently exist. They all argue that maybe things don't substantially exist, they don't self-sufficiently exist, they don't exist from their own side, they're not truly existent, but they think that they will get over all that. So what all that really means, I'll try to explain a little bit as we've got a little bit of here. But this is just a bit of general introduction. This is the big difference between the Prajnaniga school and all the other schools of Tibetan Buddhism. Only the Prajnaniga say things do not repeat. Even the Majjhimika Svatantrika school say things inherently exist. Because they argue that they didn't inherently exist, they didn't exist before. So they think they must inherently exist. They don't truly exist, but they must somehow inherently exist. Just remember, people just remind you to go back. There are things that don't exist anymore, such as the horns of the horns of the rabbit, and Father Christmas. They exist as ideas, but they don't have any reality. And of things, so things that do exist, relevant things, the Buddha says the way things actually validly exist. One thing is valuable is that they exist non-inherently. What the Prajnaniga Majjhimika school argue is that this term inherent existence, what it actually implies, the consequences of it, is that if things did inherently exist, that they would exist independently. That's what the actual meaning of inherent existence is, that things exist independently. The Buddha discovered that things do not exist independently. And that's the problem. The way we experience ourselves and everything, which we do unconsciously, instinctively, it's not something we think about anymore. We are grasping our ignorance, which is obscuring our mind, is constantly grasping at the appearance that things inherently exist. And if things inherently exist, it would logically follow that they were independent, they existed independent, not independent. That's what inherent existence really means, ultimately means. But, the Buddha points out, if you check out, whenever you investigate anything, this is something we can start to do. If we start to investigate, we can discover that things actually exist. exist to be in the world. Which is the meaning of non-infinite existence. I exist to be. Everything that validly exists somehow depends on something else. And there are three main things that things depend on, which are causes and conditions, parts, and memory. Everything. So I'm just making a complicated thing, just to remind you of the things that validly do exist. There are permanent things, such as space, and infinite, so permanent things don't depend on causes and conditions, but they do depend on parts and memory. Impermanent things, the word impermanent depends on having a T at the end. Impermanent things, which is the vast majority of anything we experience, our sense of self, our body, our mind, our clothing, everything we use, eat, see, smell, taste, touch, think about, it's all impermanent, it's changing moment by moment. So everything that's impermanent, if you check that, it depends on causes and conditions, parts, and mind. If you check out, things can't exist. It's not only that they don't do exist this way, there's no other way that they could exist. They just couldn't exist. Can you think of anything that exists that doesn't depend on causes and conditions, parts, and mind? Not dependent on the external. For example, there are people saying different stories and things all the time. This is not a flower, right? How do we know this is a flower? This is not a flower. When we look at this thing, without investigating, thinking about it, just in our ordinary daily life and so on, why do we think this is a flower? Why do we know this is a flower? It's just putting a very primitive, simple way. It appears as though this object is telling us. It's obvious that this is obviously my flower. This is a flower. It's quite like it's telling you my flower. Its appearance is obviously a flower. It's no question. But if this was true, if this is what provided things really exist. In other words, if this flower doesn't appear to depend on our mind recognizing this as a flower, calling it a flower, and a particular kind of flower, who knows what kind of flower this is. Do you know what kind of flower it is? No. What? The Jan knows what flower it is. What's it?
It's a status.
So when Jan sees the status would be held. Because this object, even though we can see it as a flower, and it appears so obviously a flower, we can't see it as a status. Because this flower, this object, has no help from its own to make us experience it as a status. But what, as soon as we know it as a status, from now on, every time we recognize this particular flower, we will hold it as a status. But the only way it can appear as a status is depending on the fact that we know it's not. It depends on the name, and us knowing the name, and us knowing it depends on us being able to connect that name with a particular kind of appearance. But when we experience this way, it doesn't seem to become that. It just seems to be that. Because if we could see this flower as a statue, if we see this object as a flower, it seems often, of course, this is a flower. It's not something else. It's not very common. It's obviously a flower. But if it was so obviously a flower from its own side, it should also obviously be called as a statue. But it doesn't. It has no power to appear as a statue. And it also has this thing. There's no power to appear as a flower from its own. There's no power to appear. It looks like it does, actually. If we're honest, it seems obviously, totally, from its own flower. This is basically just a piece of vegetation. But we label this piece of vegetation as life. We don't go around cutting every kind of vegetation and sticking it in life and may produce it. But this bit of vegetation, our culture is the same as a nice thing. A nice kind of flower, worthy of putting it in the garden. But that, all of that depends on our culture, our conditioning, and how well we can project onto this. We project that onto it.
It's a giraffe.
Something onto this, but then it appears back as though it's that thing from its own side not appearing on our own. That's the problem. And particularly the problem is when we decide things are good and bad and good and ugly. Happiness, this is happiness, this is suffering, this is good. We believe the beauty of the good and bad is really there on its own side, independently, truly existing from its own side, self-sufficiently, substantially existing from its own side. But when we investigate, we can start to at least intellectually understand that actually the way humans exist is depending on causes and conditions, hearts or not. That's the way they actually exist. But we don't actually experience them. And even if we intellectually understand this, we still, our mind, ignorance, still grasps that things are really there the way they are. So it takes a long time to break down the things, to purify our mind, to tune that mind, meditate on these things over and over again. profoundly powerful influence through understanding things are becoming the first language of parts of mind. You really have to be able to capture this appearance of true existence. You have to really identify with your own mind. You know, so just to quickly head on to the pretty long house but so in order to develop the mind view, the wisdom that is firstly understanding the intention to it and perceiving the body thing is actually exist, we have to be able to identify the wrong view, but we have to avoid two extremes. One extreme is where we negate, we reject too much, where instead of refuting true existence or inherent existence, we negate that things exist at all. And this is the major problem that we have in trying to identify objects of negation. We negate too much, thinking that nothing exists at all. We're not trying to exist in the days that things exist. Things do exist. They exist depending on the human forces and conditions of hearts and minds. What we're trying to negate is inherent existence. That is what appears to be the fact, which is not the fact, but what appears to be the fact that things exist. Not the charging of feedback, not trying to think things do exist. They do conventionally normally exist. That's the only way things exist, just conventionally normally. As soon as you investigate them, you can't say where it is. So, for example, long and short exist. There are long things and there are short things. We all agree. But those things are just conventionally, nominally existing. They don't exist. There's no independently existing long thing, or no independently existing short thing. We can talk about the long snow. Language. A long snow is nowhere near as long as a long river. But we still talk about a long snow because, relatively, depending on causes and conditions, this snow is longer than that snow. So we can call it a long snow. But it isn't a long snow. We can call it independent. Same with rivers, same with shore, same with calling bad, beautiful. We all agree that beauty exists. There are beautiful things. But it all depends, that beauty totally depends on the human. It doesn't inherently exist. Just conventionally, nominally. But it does exist. And you'll say everything is going on, just nominally, conventionally, momentarily exists. It's not solid, substantial, true existence, and current existence, rather than on its own side, the way it takes. Just because something appears in a particular way, it doesn't mean that's how it actually feels. But that's the mistake that we make all the time. The things appear to our mind in a particular way, and we make a question why it appears. We assume that appearance matches the way we water, there were flowers on and around the water. So some of those flowers are flowers, and some are artificial. They all have the appearance of flowers, and some of them are existing as flowers. So things can appear to substantially exist self-sufficiently from their own side, truly, inherently, and doesn't mean they actually exist. And in fact, in this here, they don't. Nothing exists. In fact, they hardly exist. They appear inherently, but the way they exist is non-inherently. They exist dependent or arising. Everything is a dependent arising. Everything is empty of the view of existence. Again, just to remind the point that all of this can seem very abstract and intellectual and complicated and lots of fancy words. And what's the point? The point is that we really at some point need to understand this, not just intellectually, but use it to gain mature insights requires wildly controlled by the beliefs, grasping of things and characteristics in yourself. Because it's a big deal to discover that is the basis for why we can feel it. Our diligence, our external thoughts, are ourselves. And they will to us. That's the thing. When we get confused by all this and think it's too complicated and a waste of time, it's not really necessary to know. We have to remember that there is timeless. That we are suffering, there is a cause for it, and causes the things. We don't get rid of the things, we don't get rid of the things. So, big danger of negating too much, it is saying, is the danger of negating things that actually exist. Then the other problem is
I left early last week, so. Because it's a big chapter, isn't it?
You keep going.
For that?
No, keep going.
That's the bottom of
the bottom line. It's the object, just at the very bottom. Okay. The object of negation is too narrow. Although the principles of the four seals of the Buddhist doctrine are unanimously acknowledged by all Buddhist traditions of being literally what was spoken, when we set out to identify the self which does not exist, that is referred to by the seal. All phenomena have no self. We will see that the hearers do not consider self a phenomena as an appropriate negation, let alone the selflessness resulting from its negation. So, just quickly, what this is referring to is the four seals that it refers to. The four seals of the Buddhist doctrine are four teachings that the Buddha gave, which are, one could say, unique features of Buddhist view. They are seals that identify Buddhism and all other religious or religions and philosophies. So these four seals are very good to know if you don't know them. So the first one, they're expressed in slightly different ways when you translate it. But the first one is that all compounded phenomena are impermanent. Compounded meaning everything depending on causes and conditions, compounded brought together by causes and conditions is impermanent. For those of us who've been studying Buddhism for some time, it seems very obvious after a while, I hope, that things depending on causes and conditions are impermanent. But this is actually a unique view of Buddhism. The other schools of philosophy don't accept it, including a lot of the modern science, Western modern scientists don't accept it. And I think that if you know, like, there are these people who like Michael Jackson paying all this money to have him when he died, have his body put in this fruit preserving machine so that someone he would be able to be brought alive again. But the machine that was part of it, I think actually was probably never quite put in mind eventually. But people forget that the machine that was going to take you for your life away from therefore in the life form, that machine is made by causes and conditions, so it's important to define in our lives. And people think that we have a lot of medicine to be found that we'll be able to prolong our life without medicine. But so anyway, this is actually a unique person. It's a seal of those teachings that things depending on causes and conditions are meaning they are changing moment by moment, they are decaying moment by moment. Everything depending on causes and conditions is always changing very suddenly, moment by moment. So one last word. So that's the first seal. I'll just go through this quickly. Second one is that all contaminated phenomena are suffering. Contaminated phenomena means anything which comes into existence depending on delusion and karma. So everything in our world is a product. So it's a contaminated phenomenon. A Buddha is a contaminated phenomenon. An Arahant is a contaminated phenomenon. They are not the result of delusion and karma. But everything, our body, is a product of delusion and karma. All the things we do are a result of delusion and karma. So that contaminated phenomenon and our suffering. By that, it doesn't mean that this table, which is, is actually unhappy and suffering. It doesn't mean that. It means that it's an example of what talking about giving the name of the cause to the effect. So these objects in front of me are all contaminated phenomena. So because of that, because they're produced by delusion and karma, they have the effect on me of perceiving them. They can bring suffering because I can get attached to the present objects. I can develop aversion to the unpleasant things. The suffering of attachment, the suffering of aversion. So what it's saying is that all contaminated phenomena are a source of suffering or deliverance. The third seal of the distinctions is that all phenomena are selfless. They don't, which is selflessness, again, is related to this idea of the false appearance or substantial existence, self-existence, self-sufficient existence, existing in itself, truly existing. Another term for that is that things have some kind of self-existence. So, it was the Buddhist belief that everything is self, all things are self. And finally, the Buddhist belief is that nirvana is peace. Peace means total freedom from suffering. And so the only situation which is totally free of suffering is nirvana. What is nirvana? Nirvana is when the mind is free of delusion and power, free of particularly the ignorance. It's eliminated, totally eliminated from the mind. So in a way that it will never return. That state, that is nirvana. And that is free. That is free of suffering. And only these are the four series of unique features in the Buddhist teaching. So we're trying to try to do it. You should sing it.
It's not from that yet.
No, it's
not. They interpret it differently, especially the third seal, that brought them all that a selflessness. So it says, when we set out to identify the self which does not exist, that is referred to by the seal, all phenomena of no self, we will see that the hearers, and the hearers here is referring to those who are following the two and the path to liberation, to nirvana. Non-mahayanists. What His Holmes is trying to call it, you know, is the Pali tradition as opposed to the Sanskrit tradition. Is that terminology which is in this world? Anyway, so the hearers are those who belong to the two lower philosophical schools. Do not assert a self of phenomena as an object of negation. So if you remember last week, I pointed out, do you remember this? That, I think I probably did this again. So these are the Mahayana schools, the Majjhimika and the Chittamaja, and then these are the, I hope you don't mind using this term here, I know it's not what it's supposed to be, I don't see it as an insulting term, it's the individual view, it's about achieving liberation just for oneself. This is the great vehicle about achieving your life and everything. So anyway, one big difference in the philosophical schools between the Mahayana philosophical schools and the individual philosophical schools is that the two lower schools, the schools of individual liberation, accept the selflessness of person. But they say that phenomena, or everything other than the person, truly exists. It's really out there the way it is. So that's one big difference, easy to understand difference between the two lower schools and the two Mahayana schools. But the lower schools only accept the selflessness of person, but they say that phenomena truly inherently exist. So these are the two schools which can, which is in the text is referred to as the heroes. So they accept a self-explicit person, but not trees. I don't inherently truly exist. I do exist, but I don't inherently exist according to the heroes. The trees and tables really exist the way they appear. Whereas one of the schools says everything is self-existence. Persons and all phenomena are without a self. Don't truly exist.
How can I not accept that? It seems like contradiction to the Buddhist teachings. Everything depends on cause and condition.
Sorry,
what? The heroes or the Hinayana. Why is it that they don't accept that selflessness of phenomena? Because it seems like a contradiction to the teachings.
Because they all have valid reasons for it, or what they believe to be valid reasons for arguing what they believe in particular words. For some of us here, we have been introduced to the Majjhimika, even though we don't really understand what we think we do. Well, at least we've been told everything that doesn't inherently exist, and we think because maybe we do have some rough idea of what that means, and due to the kindness of the Lama who sort of explained it, it seems, oh yeah, that makes sense, so how come everyone doesn't understand that? But those who in the past, they haven't impacted. They weren't introduced to those, that view.
Okay.
And as far as I know, like in Theravada countries, these teaching, these views don't exist. They're not taught because they're not considered to be true, you know, valid and true.
So they've never heard that in the other person.
I'm not sure. I wouldn't, but they certainly didn't study them because they don't accept them as being the teachings of the Buddha. These are the teachings of the Buddha. In Pali Sutra.
Closed communities
open,
rather than community oriented,
you know,
closed within themselves, these
are
their own
people.
Are they?
No, I'm not trying to say that they're closed like that, but it's just. Tibet was also very closed in one sense, but they have. Tibet was a very. They can even be literally allowed to run into the country. In their history. But they were fortunate that Tibetan Buddhism has all the teachings of the two high schools, of the two lower schools and the two higher schools.
So they just have a different focus, really.
Well, we don't. If you study properly the traditions, they do try and, firstly, there's this topic, there's this subject area called Dripta, which is the tenets, which is explaining the rules of the hardship or satanic and so on. And when you set certain monasteries, that's what they do. They study the lowest, the first school, the hardship is still first. And what do they do? And then because. Yeah, and that's what's encouraged. You just don't study the positive, because if you do, you won't really the suffering. If I think one is, but it's not really.
Mm-hmm.
phenomenon. Yes, yes.
Then you're not saying, oh, there's no self on the part. Or your legal say, but there's true this, that there's been no self power to the church of the priest. If they've got this and they have logic.
No. Well, actually, these days, they're more complicated. In the Theravada tradition, it gets to it now. I mean, I haven't really studied it very much, but not what I've heard from some Theravada monks these days, teaching or whatever, they seem to just talk about it, that according to the Theravada view, that it isn't the eye at all. There isn't the eye at all. And that's actually from a certain point of view, nihilism. If I may have misunderstood what they were saying, but that's what some Theravada monks these days seem to be saying, there isn't an eye at all. And I know there was a teacher who I think she was actually Dutch, but she was following the Theravada tradition, and she was teaching in a way that people were using the art instead of unconscious shock, sorry, unconscious shock, and they don't realize selflessness because there is no life. That's right. I'm sorry. Oh no, I'm not trying to criticize the Theravada tradition as such. I'm not really not doing that.
I'm just commenting.
Tibetans have lots of Tibetan system has lots of extreme practices too.
I
won't Yeah, well, this is not just Westerners. This is a human thing of identifying the body as a being. Anyway, trying to explain this is not hard enough. So the hearers do not assert a self as a phenomenon, let alone the self instance resulting from this invention. They take the blame in the hearers, the two lower schools, take the self instance of the four seers, self instance referred to as all phenomena as selflessness, to be the mere selflessness of the person. Right? So even though the four seals says all phenomena are selfless, the hearers interpret that meaning, or it doesn't mean all phenomena, it means just the phenomenon of the person is selfless. And then how they interpret that selflessness is being merely empty of being self-sufficient, substantially existing entity. So from a Madhyamika point of view, this view of selflessness, of the person being empty, of being substantially and self-sufficiently existing, is a very gross understanding of selflessness. It's not really understanding fully what the Buddha means. It's only a partial understanding. So what self-sufficient means is something like the meaning of self-sufficient is existing through the object's own power. And substantially existing means a person having different characteristics from the five aggregates, is in control of them and not dependent on them. That's why if such a person existed, it would be a person that was different from the five aggregates. The five aggregates refers to the body, the mind, there's the format, the book, which is the body, and then the other four aggregates are aspects of the mind. There are feelings, discriminations, primary consciousnesses, rather than the physical or compounded phenomena, which is referring to every other aspect of the mind, such as all our delusions, all our positive mental factors, such as the idea of compulsion, and so on. So, the hearers are saying that the selflessness of persons is referring to a person that there is a wrong view that there is a person that is substantially and self-sufficient in existence. So the hearers say that that view is wrong, that the person is empty of feeling that way. But what the Majjhimita is saying is that even though they accept that selflessness, they still grasp that the person is currently existing. So it goes on. Still continuing this explanation of the third seal that the animal thinking into to talk about the what the wise schools. So it goes on to say, for those great pioneers who propounded the system of mere awake awareness or mind only, the Chukamaka school, the seal concerning the non-existence of self implies the selflessness of both persons and phenomena. In other words, the Chittamarkins accept that selflessness applies to both phenomena, the person and phenomena. And with respect to the latter, in other words, in relation to the selflessness of phenomena, the self of phenomena, this is the wrong view, the self of phenomena is the distinct entity of the object and the perceiver. So if you believe in phenomena as being having self, meaning that they are truly existing, substantially existing, self-sufficiently existing, which is what we're grasping at, this is because that wrong view arises because of believing and grasping that there is a distinct difference in the identity between object and the perceiver. So the Chittamarkins assert that the lack of such identity is the selflessness of phenomena. What does this mean? I'll try to briefly explain. So the mind-only school argues that this is a Buddhist system of philosophy, argues that death is everything is mind, is only mind. Although there is an appearance of external phenomena, there isn't anything real out there. It's all just produced by our mind. Just like a dream. In a dream, it seems when we are dreaming, I am in that dream, there's me and there is external phenomena. It appears to be in the dream, me wandering around in an external world. But in reality, it's all produced by the dreamer's mind. So the Chittamarkins are saying actually reality is like that, that everything we're experiencing is just being a projection of my mind. So that the selflessness of a phenomena is understood by the Chittamarkins external phenomena are entity of being separate from them. I mean, that's just a close way. Or being closed by them. Or to the margins of someone, the one that is thinking things are outwardly separate from them. Or their own substantial existence, but actually their entity. Something separate. What the Chittamantins say in their texts, just very roughly, is that we create women with bad karma all the time. So that means positive and negative actions which generate karma impacts. So according to the Chittamantra, when these karmic imprints, when they bind you, they have two aspects. They create karma. Two aspects of the experience of the subject experiencing suffering, and the other aspect of that imprint is the appearance of what the subject is experiencing. These two things arise, the karmic imprint arises to give rise to two things, the person experiencing something and the feeling they're experiencing. It's all coming from these imprints in the mind. That's the Chittamantra view, which is not the highest view, it's wrong. Very interesting view, and it helps us to realize that things do come up. But the Majjhimagga is saying, yes, things really do come up in our mind a lot, but not so extremely as that. But it's helpful to start to understand, because it breaks down the lower views that things are out there separately, independently, truly existing. So the Chittamantins are on the path of the idea that they've got it, they've gone too extreme in oneself. Okay, so their selflessness of phenomena is that external phenomena are empty of being, just putting this very primitive, there is a proper, correct philosophical way of expressing it, but just to give a rough idea. So, the Chittamantra view of the selflessness of phenomena is that phenomena are hidden, or they lack the self of being separate from the mind that is experiencing them. So, then it goes on to say the propounders of entitylessness include entitylessness, which is the middle way schools of two types, the consequentialists, which is the Prasangika school, the highest one, and the Svartantrikas, which can be translated as the inherent validators. Because they believe in inherent existence. They don't believe in true existence, but the Svartantrikas do believe in inherent existence.
Can I ask, what's a propounder?
A propounder? Oh, that's a good question. Propounder is a tenet holder. What is a tenet holder? Tenet holder is someone who is has arrived at a belief in some view about something through a strong logical conviction. They have logical reasons for believing that. They understand that logic, or think they do, and they hold on to that. like for us as Buddhists, we hear the Lamas explain things and we think, oh, that must be right. But we could never really explain it from our understanding that was in place. Oh, so just generally speaking, on a deep logical understanding. Most people follow most religions without which Christian, if you ask them, what is the actual philosophy of Christianity? Most priests and others, if you experts, actually know what the doctrines of Christianity are. But everyone has faith in the Christians have faith. So most Buddhists don't understand all philosophical teachings. They just have a general power like that. But a tenet holder is someone who understands the philosophical position, and agrees with it because they've come to a very strong logical belief, conviction about it, so they propound that view because they hold it sincerely, really strongly. So in the past in India, the Buddhist masters used to have these huge debates with the non-Buddhists. There's all sorts of amazing stories that where they have these huge debates, which are practically life and death debates, because the idea was that if you lost the debate, you and all your disciples had to follow the tradition that lost you, because you couldn't support your argument, you couldn't prove it was right, the other side won, they proved or opponent proved that their position was right, so you had to follow them. So it was really, everyone's out to win. And all sorts of funny stories and things about how they would try to, and of course some of these masters had psychic powers, and so they would use their psychic powers to win. There's the funny story. Somebody was arguing with some of the Indian master, and they both had psychic powers, and they wanted to produce this illusion of the other person. So the other person would get confused a bit by it, and they produce some other magic to communicate with. And it's so stupid, is it?
It's a long time
ago. Exactly. There's a couple of other ones that I've known. Something about one of the debaters appeared with a cat, and the other was a mouse, and the cat had the mouse, and things like that. But there's another story which the threatened me like to tell about one of the debaters appeared as a beautiful woman who said to distract. In the other devotees of the Christian practitioners. They should have flashed themselves so that the lady got all shocked and so that debate lost it. And it's actually depicted in its tundras that I've actually seen. There's a scene called the Great Masters in the corner, that bit is often played. And this also happened in the life story of the Buddha, that these different yogis would come and debate with the Buddha and say, we have never got your teachings in touch. And then the Buddha would proceed to talk and teach, and sometimes describe miracles, and people were converted. Hundreds of people at the time. So, just trying to carry on a little bit more. Actually, maybe we should stop here. It's long for the moment. Sometimes the arguments can seem very, just very very abstract and academic, and just too esoteric and all of that, and too complicated to understand. But to some people are academically inclined and not very attractive to these things, but other people don't have much experience in having this kind of study, certainly at the moment. But it's really important to not be upset by it. And just listening and trying to make some sense of some things, and then listen to it through again or read about it in a few more points or the same way, and it starts to make some sense. And slowly, slowly, or if not necessarily slowly, slowly, but gradually, gradually, one's mind starts to become familiar with the concepts and put the jigsaw together, and gradually one starts to get a clearer idea of what things there. This is the most important thing to try and make. If you don't understand these things, you can start to understand them, but the precious human birth of optimal chance to do that. Maybe in his lifetime's work, but at least we can start to put the influence around one another. Because the more we become familiar with it, the more we will understand it. But that's how the mind works. Why we can't do things is because we're not familiar with it. Why we can't understand things is because we're not familiar with this series of concepts. But the nature of the mind is to know. If we let it know, we will. One can't stop the mind from knowing. There's no way the mind will ever stop knowing. So if we let it know, we will. And if we work on purifying the mind, it makes it easier for the mind to get rid of the stuff that's blocking the mind. It's like if you've got a hose with those nozzles on the equipment and taps turn on, the nozzles turn off. So all the water is in the hose just waiting to go out, but it's blocked. It can't. And if you turn the nozzle a little bit, so the water can come out. If you turn the lock, all the water will come out. It's just, if the energy is there, it's trying to come out all the time, it taps on. So our mind is like a tap turned on. The mind is knowing, it just wants to know that it sets on. That's what it's doing, but it's blocked. All of our delusions, confusions, negative images, and so on. So if we could know how we want to know, we should have our mind empowered. These things start to make much more sense of course we have some of them. We can explain them from that helps a lot. But I hope I can give some simple information for you. Okay, thank you very much. We can dedicate the knowledge of this time. Through the merits of his virtuous action, may I quickly attain the state of the Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the precious body mind not deform and rise and grow. May that form have no decline, but in peace forevermore. The object of refuge for myself and all the transmigration beings in all our lifetimes is the embodiment of the three jewels, the all-encompassing three refuges in one. With the root of which flowers and jewels, this volume is the Dalai Lama. The Master, Padma Sambhava, the Dharma King, Sons of Rahu, and Sri Sri Dasan, the other Chandrakshita, and the numerous holy beings who preserve and spread the Buddha Dharma in Tibet, and the Tibetan people who practice and serve Buddhism so faithfully for 1,000 years, as well as those who, along with many others, died sacrificing their lives to Tibet and His Holiness. May all their positive wishes be fulfilled immediately. Due to their limitless kindness, the sun of Tibetan Buddhism has now risen in the west, which is the dark rain. But now that I have met with the Dharma, I have received the perfect embodiment, enabling me to lead a meaningful life.
Remembering this, we make the following dedication prayers. May all the souls that Dalai wishes be successful in unity. May the snow lift to bring achieve pure freedom and develop the Buddha Dharma even more than before.
And may all mother transmigrate the green to achieve enlightenment quickly. And on the wall, Save from the snow land teachings and transmigratory beings who makes extremely clear the path that is unification, gentleness, and compassion. To the lotus holder, Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech. May all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. You who uphold the Buddha's moral way, who serve the outward aware of all, sustaining, preserving, spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish the gifts of grace, honoring the three joys, save with myself and others your disciples, please live long. Lord of Dharma, in accordance with the various dispositions of those who have served you, makes clear in the light of your well-spoken advice the sacred ground and tradition, essence of Buddha's teachings. O foremost and holy Lama, to you who are supreme, O Lama, please.
At the end of this month, not the end of the